Here's Higdon. It sits up nicely for Michael Higdon. And what a start for Motherwell. But here's Malt, and he goes for it first time. Magnificent Malt. Stephen Robinson celebrates. Motherwell, two up. And could that be the goal that puts him into the Betfred Cup final?
He's got Irwin. The supporting links from Ainsworth on the angle. Lionel Ainsworth fires home.
It's Lasley deep into stoppage time. Up goes Sutton. No foul given. Kerr. And Reid is there to knock it in. The goal is given. Hesitation for Craig Reid, who scores his first ever goal in senior football. And what a moment for Motherwell.
Hello and welcome to the MFC podcast. Today I've got another special guest on, Brian Jackson. Brian was, of course, the administrator of Motherwell Football Club following the club entering administration back in April 2002. Of course, it was only a few weeks ago that Pat Nevin joined me in the podcast, so I'm sure we'll revisit some of the issues discussed in that podcast and then we'll progress beyond that. Brian, I'm absolutely delighted you've given up the time to speak to me today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, go all the way back to April 2002, incredibly over 17 years ago now, the arrival at Fir Park, the first day in that press conference in the Davy Cooper suite, was that the darkest time, that first day in the arrival, given the gravity of the situation?
Well, firstly, you know, it's incredible, it was so long ago now when I think about it, because you know, normally I don't know where I left my keys about 5 minutes ago as I get older, but
that doesn't bode well for the
next day. It doesn't really, but no, but obviously lots of things as you get older, things way back in the past do stick quite a bit in your mind, particularly events like that. And it didn't really, it felt really dark. Obviously it was a bit of a shock, I think, to Scottish football, because prior to that, yes, there'd been a casualty here and there, but it was the first SPL casualty, and I don't think anybody ever believed it could happen to a football club. People mistakenly thought, and maybe understandably as well, is because football clubs have a fan base, it will just never happen. So even when there was overspending and things going wrong, I think you always thought, well, the next white knight's over the horizon, it's just not going to happen. And of course, for years and years, it just didn't happen, or it rarely happened. So I think it was a shock to everybody, including myself, really, that I was actually sitting there thinking, you know, what we're actually going to do. And of course it was early days for the insolvency of a football club, so it was kind of unknown, I think, to not just everybody else out there, but also to me, as to how we're going to navigate ourselves through this.
How bad was the situation on arrival? The financial problems were clearly extreme. How was this presented to you? As I said, with reference back to the Pat Nevin podcast, he put it to me that a buyer was waiting in the wings and he believed there was a way out of this and admin wasn't necessary. How was it presented to you coming into Fir Park?
Well, I didn't hear Pat Nevin's, unfortunately, and Pat was away by the time I arrived, but I'm not too sure how he reached that conclusion, because the situation that had happened in the background just generally is that Scottish football got overheated in terms of the TV money came in, wages went up, chasing the Holy Grail, chasing the TV money. Obviously, the higher you are in the league, the more money you get. So that was all happening. But then, of course, the TV money came back down. But the players' wages didn't automatically come back down. That was obviously going to take quite a while, you know, to balance itself out. So Motherwell, like quite a number of clubs, were overheated. And when you're dependent, really, on external backing and it's not being self-generated, and as soon as something happens to that person or that person's finances, then you're in a situation you can't get out of. So Motherwell's situation was, apart from the debt that was there, there was a level of debt. Their bigger problem was that they had a huge squad on really high wages, and their wages were actually 130% to turnover. That's just players' wages. So if your backer, who's propping that up, stops for whatever reason or can't maintain it, then you can't, you literally can't pay the wages. So I'm not too sure how Pat thought administration could have been avoided. I'm not aware of, There was plenty of talk of buyers, of course, but I'm not aware if there was actually any buyer there waiting to say, right, I'm going to take over right now. Because if he had, he's quite right. You'd have avoided administration. That person would have taken on the problem and would have had to manage it down. But there was no buyer that I was aware of, because in actual fact, it took me 2 years to sort it out because I never found a buyer, which no doubt we'll come on to.
Yeah, we certainly will. So you've mentioned excessive spending. There was the television deal collapse as well as Motorola, who were the title sponsors. They suffered similar financial problems, and so in turn the sponsorship takes a dip as well. Was it accumulation of factors that just blew up, essentially?
Yes, it's unfortunately the cliche, I suppose, is the perfect storm, isn't it? You know, the TV money comes down, you've invested very heavily in a player squad. You're also hoping, I think another thing that happened was that you're hoping by the team performing well, which it was doing on the pitch, that your average, let's say your home crowd is, you know, 4,000 or so. You're hoping that's going to go to 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, you know, you're budgeting to be able to deal those wages by that happening. But it doesn't really happen in football clubs, because what you actually find is you have a core support. So the 4,000, when you're doing really well, it might go to 5,000. When you're doing really badly, it might go to 3,500, you know, because you've got your core support. So I don't think the turnover was going up in terms of pro rata to the performances. So there wasn't the return maybe expected or hoped for on that basis. Yes, you had the sponsor coming out, you had the TV money coming down, players' wages really high, so you're quite right. It was a combination of all of that.
The redundancies followed shortly afterwards. Was that a necessary evil? There was obviously 9 players that were approaching the end of their deals, but there was also 10 players who still had a year or more left in the contract. That must have been a difficult process, and there was a lot of anger, understandably so, amongst some of those players that were released from the football club.
Yes. What happens in administration is that to keep the doors open, you have to self-generate. There's no external money coming in, so it has to be pound in, pound out. So you have to look at what your ongoing turnover is going to be and make sure you can pay all your costs, players' wages, non-wages, etc. So there was only two options. One really was close down the club, in which case it goes into liquidation and it kind of dies, really, and you know, you sell off the ground and all the players' contracts fall and you lose value overnight. Everything's worth really next to nothing. Or you find a way of keeping the doors open, and hopefully that maintains value. Because your job as administrator obviously is the best return possible to creditors, albeit of course you're desperately, from a humanitarian point of view, trying to save the club. But they do go hand in hand. So you look at, how can I keep the doors open? Well, the second option, keeping the doors open, the only way to do that was to make absolutely brutal savings. So we had to get rid of all the top players, top earners, and quite a number of non-players as well. There was absolutely no option, otherwise I couldn't get the doors open. So as difficult as it was, and yes, it created a massive amount of anger. I mean, this was kind of unprecedented, really, I think, the scale of it. And a lot of the anger ended up being personally directed towards me. But, you know, that's the job. You know, I understand that. Some players, I obviously would never mention who they are, actually gave me absolute abuse, wrote to me for months, accusing me of all kinds of things. The reality is their job was redundant and I was just doing my job. And I was trying to keep the doors open on a reduced scale rather than close the doors. And that's what I was faced with, really.
I read a quote from you at the time. You said the club would have to be leaner, more cost-effective and more attractive to a potential buyer. I suppose having that out-of-control wage bill, it's not going to be attractive whatsoever, is it? So it kind of goes hand in hand that you would have to have that wage bill down to a level where someone could come in and manage it, because it had spiralled to such an out-of-control extent.
That was exactly it, Andrew. It was hand in hand. Firstly, I couldn't get the doors open with that wage bill. And secondly, nobody would want to buy the club at that wage bill. So they were hand in hand, and it was going to make it, first of all, it'd like to keep the doors open. Secondly, you're right, it would make it more attractive to somebody to come in, because I was getting the club to at least break even situation, which it wasn't before that. But it didn't pan out that way, which kind of, I have to say, did surprise me. As I say, it was a bit of an unknown for all of us at the time. I expected a club like Motherwell to find a buyer quite easily. Maybe that was partly my own naivety. But it wasn't expensive to buy it. And it's a really nice community club. It's always brought great players through. The positive, you all try and find some positives out the negatives. One of the positives was a lot of the young boys who weren't getting a game were beginning to get a game and were beginning to emerge and in fact attract value. Mm. And they were getting a chance to play. So there were some good things were coming out of the administration in, from that point of view. And I was surprised that the buyers didn't appear. I mean, I had lots of interested parties, but they all got cold feet. It was a bit like the White Knights were just disappearing over the horizon, thinking, wait a minute, yes, we could buy the club fairly cheap and take it on, but what about working capital? What if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? How did it get into that situation? Looking at other clubs who were beginning to struggle as well. So the buyers who were actually the local type consortiums, they had the right interests at heart in terms of wanting to take over the club and help save the club and take over administration, but they were too nervous financially. And I don't think they quite had the financial weight that was required. So I was in the situation of trading on, looking for a buyer, thinking that yes, I'll find one, and all I need to do is keep the doors open to them. Now the problem with doing that, sorry if I rabbit on too much, just interrupt me.
Not at all.
The problem with doing that was I had to get the cost down. So took all the initial costs out, but I had to retain a structure. I've got to obviously have a team to play and honour commitments of the club. So I was in a difficult situation in that I still had a deficiency in my budget for year one. So I remember I met with the heads of the supporter groups fairly early on, and they wanted to know, first of all, how the administration worked, which I tried to explain. But then, secondly, they were already quite angry because I had sold a player. Went to Hull.
Stuart Elliott,
thank you. Stuart Elliott, 150,000 was my recollection. And they said, how could you sell Stuart Elliott, fan favourite, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, look, you know, either, as you remind me of my quote, you know, either we've got a scaled down club or no club. So I explained to them, I said, there's my budget for the year. There's a 300,000 deficiency. That's 150,000 of it solved. I've still got deficiency, and I'm looking for you guys to help in any way you can. So either we keep a scaled down club or no club. So they perhaps didn't like the answer, but at least they understood it. And it was actually quite interesting, for I used to have fairly regular meetings, and after a while they said to me, Brian, we quite like this administration. We're finding out more about the way the club's run than we ever did. And it might be because I was always quite transparent. I've always done that in any job I've done, football or non-football, I always believe in transparency, because if you explain to people why you're doing it, it helps them. They might not even agree with you, but at least they know why you're doing it. So I think that did help the situation, and that they saw that I had to get these costs down, because really what I was setting them up for is I'll probably have to sell another player, or I'll have to raise money in a different way, or I'll have to make even more cuts to keep the doors open. So that was the initial period, and at that stage I thought, okay, it's on the market, we'll find a buyer.
Yeah, you touched on quite a lot of the things in the next couple of questions that I've got down here. The focus obviously shifted a couple of days later, and the Well Worth Saving campaign is at the forefront of that. Alistair Barron described the club as a sick relative in need of care. A lot of the objectives seem to be bringing the football club into the community, establishing how important the football club was to the community, and I guess hoping the community would rally around and get the football club through this initial spell, this difficult time. And there was a Kilmarnock game a couple of days later where emotions ran high, the young players really put on a display in what many of us thought maybe the last time we ever saw our football club. That obviously wouldn't be the case. There was the Kievo friendly, which attracted a big crowd for a kickabout, essentially.
Yep.
And then the Dundee game, nearly 7,000 at Fir Park for the last game of the season. Last game of the season quite often attracts a few more punters through the door, the weather can be a bit nicer. There may be something to play for. It may be a farewell to some players that have served the club well. But the punters were getting behind this, and guys like Keith Brown and Matt Johnson put in incredible amounts of work to get the Well Worth Saving campaign off the ground. How important were they to the initial stages especially?
Huge importance. I mean, what tends to happen, of course, is fans mobilise when there's a crisis. You don't expect them to mobilise before it. Why should they? You know, they pay their money and they go and see the games. And then they get the fright of, wait a minute, we might actually lose our club. You know, it's a part of people's lives. So what they did was fantastic, because it was some of the kind of intangibles of it. It wasn't just that they were helping raise money. Is they were helping raise a spirit around the club, which was keeping it going, because it becomes difficult, for example, to sell sponsorship because of the unknown. You don't know if the doors are going to continue being open. Selling the tables commercially proved to be difficult. I was hoping we'd get a lot of support there, and we did get support, but not as much as I thought we might. But again, that's very difficult. People are spending money out of their companies, and they don't know how long you're going to be there, or the doors will still be open. So that was difficult. But I think the work they were doing maintained a level of income that just kept coming in that might not have. If everybody just put their heads down, nobody made any effort, then we'd have certainly been in a much more difficult situation in keeping the club going.
Yeah, and another thing I wanted to touch on, the staff that remained at the club. Now, there's still some of those staff members at the football club just now. How important were they in keeping up the morale, the non-playing staff? They're obviously the spine of the organisation, the Indians.
Yes. You made a really good point, though, and, you know, I don't want to be too cheesy about it, but the reality is that the staff of the club were absolutely fantastic. A lot of them already been there for quite a long time, and the ones that stayed on made huge contributions. Of course, because it's a bit of a community club, everybody knows everybody. And when I went back, actually, was it last year, there were two of the girls in the office are still there 18 years on, which is just incredible, which just shows you the pool of the club and the community
that's there. It's just so ingrained in people's lives. It is such a massive part of my life. It's a massive part of my family's life. The football club is at the centre of everything you do, bizarrely. You obviously go to your work and you've got a family, but the football club is that one constant that was in jeopardy.
And I understand that. The reasons why that is, you know, that's probably another podcast, and the reasons are probably very interesting, but I understand that situation. That's why you do everything you can possibly, as do the fans, to help save the club. But then, again, it's back to an intangible of the effort they were putting in. Well, first of all, it was the tangible effort, of course, that we were on a skeleton staff who were doing a fantastic job running the club, running it efficiently, effectively. But the intangible was the spirit that it creates around it. Because the Motherwell job, strangely enough, was probably, you know, I've tended to say that when I get these kind of jobs, because it's precarious, it's unknown, you don't know if there'll be a buyer, it's kind of 50-50 if you'll get it over the line. And I felt that at Motherwell, but I always felt a confident 50-50. My subsequent jobs, I didn't feel that way at all. But the Motherwell one I did, for all different types of reasons. But there was a feel about it that the fans would not allow the club to die in any way, the Well Worth Saving and everything else. I just felt there was a community spirit there. I felt it was a really attractive club to a lot of people, including the fans, that we would find a way. So I was always kind of quietly optimistic that we would come out of administration.
You mentioned the attractive element. Around that Kilmarnock game and the closing games of the season, there was rumours of a Dutch consortium waiting on the wings. Yeah. How much merit was there to that?
Ach, it's like all the rumours in, you know, the football world. You know, you get these rumours just all the time, and all you really need is a phone call from somebody, two lines in the press from someone, you know, showing an interest.
Well, unfortunately for you here, I've went through every story from 2002 and 2003, so there may be a few rumours to address here.
Yeah, well, there might be, but I have to tell you, they were absolutely all rumours, because we got to the end of year one. And I may be preempting the next couple of questions, I don't know, but we got to the end of year one, and I was kind of a bit of shock in that no buyer. So I've been talking to quite a few interested parties, the main ones were really local fans, those kind of people, because the other people I was talking to, and I can't really recall how many. There was quite a few. I think I did talk to the Dutch people. There was some Italians I spoke to. There were all different people I spoke to, but I don't have a great recollection because, to be honest, at the time I was thinking, none of these are going to be a preferred bidder. You know, it's just talk. There's nothing concrete. I can't see evidence of funding. Yes, they're kind of interested, but they don't really seem that keen. I don't feel there's anything going to develop here. So I get to the end of year one, I'm thinking, so all these people everyone were talking about, they don't really exist. because they can buy the club quite cheap. So if they're not, you know, if it hasn't happened after a year, it's not happening. So I'm back to really local consortiums, hopefully. I'm not sure where I go from here. That's where it was at the end of year one.
Yeah, and you said over those summer months that the fate that befell Airdrie would have occurred to Motherwell if John Boyle and the directors hadn't taken the route of administration. Quite frankly, that's a pretty terrifying thought.
Yes, yes, it was. So we got to the end of year one and looking at strategy, what we're actually going to do here. Well, as I say, some good comes out of the bad sometimes. And what good did come out of it was going into year two, we had a squad of players, a lot of young boys who'd been thrown in much earlier than they should have. And you know that can be hard, physicality and the mentality, when you don't have a balance of older players. So we'd probably too many that had been thrown in too quickly, but of course some of them were beginning to emerge. And that learning curve, we took it into year two. And I think the learning curve also, I hope Teddy doesn't take this the wrong way, but probably added on to him as well. I think year two he was a better manager because he had year one in very difficult circumstances behind him. Mm-hmm. And I thought his management and the way the players rose their game in year two was absolutely fantastic. So that really helped us. So that got our profile up. Obviously, we got more money in terms of winning games, doing better in the league. So that really helped. And as these players emerged, I saw another route for us. If we can sell players for enough money, I can then do a deal with the creditors. Because normally the way you do it is you sell the shares to somebody, that gives you enough money to do the deal with the creditors. Mm. But nobody was buying the shares from me. So the original shareholders pre-administration continued to be the same shareholders, including John Boyle. So I actually spotted a different route as we were going. I thought, because James McFadden was coming through and he was becoming worth money. Stephen Pearson ended up being worth money. And in fact, if his contract had been running out, I think he'd have been worth more than I managed to get for him. So I saw this route emerging and I thought, if I could sell those players for that amount of money, and by year two, I was just about getting to break even, mm-hmm. you know, so the club's more attractive going forward. I think there's a deal to be done here. And what happened was, as you know, we sold Jane McFadden, we sold Stephen Pearson, and that money gave us the 25p in the pound, which the creditors accepted. So we got out of administration in a kind of unusual way, not one I'd envisaged at the beginning.
It's almost that element of sink or swim, isn't it? The young guys thrown in, maybe a few of them too early, but the survival instincts kick in and you've got to step up. And many of them did, like so Keith Lasley and Stephen Hamill as well, just off the top of my head, along with like Safadi and Stephen Pearson.
Well, they did. They did really well. And as it happens, and of course you don't say this publicly, certainly not at the time, it's probably easier in a more relaxed environment to talk about it now, but at the time the performances on the field wasn't the number one thing to me. Saving the club, not saving the season, is the number one. Yes, you want to do well, and the better you do on the field, the better your finances tend to be off the field as well. Of course it can knock on, but my priority was to save the club. And my duty was to put a team out on the field, but I had to put it out on what I could afford. And I remember actually one reporter congratulating me in year two when the performances really came up a notch and saying, Brian, you know, it's fantastic what the young boys are doing and very brave of you to have thrown all these boys in, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, what do you mean? I said, I'd love to take the credit, but we had to play who we had. We had no choice. That's all we could afford. I said, your credit goes to them. They've actually upped their game. But I said, credit can go to the management if you want, but it can't go to me because I never got involved, of course, in the football side. I would never do that. All I can do is say, look, this is all we can afford. Here's your players. But as I say, it wasn't the biggest concern for me. The biggest concern for me was getting the club to break even so I can keep the doors open and get a deal and take it out of administration. Mm. How they perform on the field was secondary to that. Yes, of course I want them to perform well, but it wasn't something that was... What was keeping me awake at nights was actually just keeping the doors open.
Yeah, of course. And again, I keep on referencing quotes from yourself over this course of time. The summer, Eric Delamo and Stuart Elliott, as you already mentioned, left the club. That freed up a little bit of space for new players to come in.
It did. I mean, Eric was on, I think my recollection was he was our highest paid player. And of course I wanted to keep him, but couldn't. But when he went and another few players went, we did bring in players. And I remember a bit of criticism, and particularly from other clubs, who just didn't like that. You go into administration and then you bring in players. But actually, I brought in less net players and went out. So financially, I actually made a saving. But it did allow me, yes, it did allow me to bring in two or three players, which we had to do. But there was actually a net saving.
And you were, of course, adamant as well that there wouldn't be a fire sale. The likes of McFadden and Pearson wouldn't be sold on the cheap. And there was a number of derisory bids over that time.
Well, I was totally bluffing at the time. I can say that now. And I was kind of...
It worked because 17 years on.
I was kind of trying to tough it out because, yes, I was saying publicly, obviously I'm trying to get the maximum because to do a deal with the creditors, I need to get as much in as I can. So I'm publicly, of course, having to tough it out and say, look, there's no fire sale. And to some extent, there wasn't. I wasn't going to be bullied or pushed into it. But the reality was I was really struggling week to week, pound in, pound out. And a lot of people were trying to take advantage of that. But I remember actually that Craig Brown offered £300,000 for James. And I think James was a bit insulted as well as ourselves. But I don't blame him. You know, he's doing the best for his club. He spots an opportunity. And my actual response to that club was... I was professional enough to put it in writing, because I got an offer in writing saying, you know, I have to reject your offer. And I said, P.S., did you miss a zero? And I actually did do that. And I just couldn't resist it. So I was trying to just indicate, look, there's no fire sale here. If you want to make a proper offer, that's fine. Come back to me. But at the time, I was really wavering, thinking, you know, but I suppose the only thing I could do was really say that publicly.
Yeah, and I guess your pessimism began to show over time. The quote I've got from October 2002, you're mentioning that things are looking a lot bleaker. You mentioned that you were far more pessimistic than you were 6 months ago. There's 12 parties that indicated interest, but they'd all fallen by the wayside. Ian Adams is... bid for the club, he was given an 8-week deadline, hadn't come through on that. You did mention though that there wasn't any chance of the club folding in the short term. Though, was your enthusiasm or your positivity levels beginning to wane somewhat?
It was. As I say, it was always 50-50. And I was quietly optimistic I'd get the administration over the line at some point, but I did go through spells where that 50-50 dipped below. It was on the wrong side. And that was because all your buyers disappear. You're still struggling to get to pound in, pound out because you need to keep a structure there. You know, you don't want to destroy the club, but you're getting to the stage where you're still having to make cuts. And even at that reduced level where somebody could come in and pick up a break-even club, at quite a small amount, you're thinking, well, what do I need to do here? You know, there just seems to be no market for it, which I found really surprising. If I'd had the money, I'd have probably bought the club myself. I mean, I thought it was a really attractive proposition. So, yes, my head went down a bit in terms of, well, where do I go now? How can I get us out of this? And that's when, as I saw players emerging and having value, I thought, if I can promote that value and get clubs interested, I could actually use that money, pay the creditors, and just leave the shareholders as they are. So you've got the same shareholder. If you don't have a new shareholder that's come in, that now owns the club, but we're out of administration and we're debt-free, and The cost structure, of course, is totally down to at least at worst break even. And that means the club will be able to continue in a healthy situation, which fortunately is the way it turned out in the end. But you're quite right, I was wavering, and I was trying to put a real brave face on it, and I was having lots of sleepless nights.
Was it round about that point that the possibility of John returning to the football club, was that always something in the back of your mind, or did that come to the forefront as the struggle for
I wouldn't say it was ever at the forefront. I would say I was just looking at every option, and that was one of them. You know, just every option. Is there a way that John can restructure and he can do a deal with the creditors? But of course, that wasn't really feasible, because that's why he'd gone into administration. You know, he'd drawn a line on his finances in terms of what he'd put into the club. I think it's well documented how much he lost, genuinely lost, in terms of his investment in the club. But I was just looking, I was grasping it. Let's look at any option we've got. I think Terry and I was even, I think at one point we were talking about, could we raise some money somehow? Can we maybe get a consortium going? You know, I genuinely think we looked at just about everything. But in fact, I remember Terry saying, we got on very well, and he said, Brian, we'd work together brilliantly. That'd be great, actually, if we could get a consortium together and you and I were actually involved, even as shareholders, etc. And I said, no, Terry, I said, you and I would fall out. He said, what do you mean? I said, it's because I would never be able to give you what you want. You know, when you say to me, look, you know, I need a centre forward and I need a centre half, and I'm watching the same games as you, and I know you do, and I want to give it to you because I'm a football supporter, I'm desperate to give it to you, like all fans' aspirations, but I would have to say no, because I'm a financial man, and if we don't have the money, I'd be saying no, so you and I would just fall out.
Delighted to announce that beer52.com will be the title sponsor of the MFC podcast for the 2019-2020 season. And as a loyal listener of our show, we'd like to reward you with free beer. All you need to do is go to beer52.com/MFC and cover just $4.95 for the postage. As an added bonus for MFC podcast listeners, you'll get an extra 2 free beers, a total of 10 beers for just $4.95. Beer52 is the world's largest craft beer discovery club. And the beauty of Beer 52 is they don't hold you to ransom. There's no lock-in and you can leave at any time. Your first box will be sent to you next day and will contain beer from all over the world. Just head on over to beer52.com/MFC to get your first case of 8 free beers for free. And don't forget, as a listener to the MFC podcast, you'll get an extra 2 unmissable beers. That's Beer 52, beer in the numbers 5 and 2.com/MFC. It doesn't end there. We're also going to offer a competition for a free case of Beer 52 beers. All you need to do is get in touch via our Twitter page, MFC Podcast 86, and tell us who will score the first goal in Saturday's St Johnstone versus Motherwell game. Should there be more than one winner, we'll draw the names out of hat and we'll announce the winner on Monday. Thanks for taking part, and remember to visit beer52.com/MFC today.
The team dropped to bottom of the table quite quickly that season. Inevitable run, I guess, of poor results. One positive of the 2002-03 season was a run to the Scottish Cup semi-final. How pivotal was the revenue generated from that in keeping the club afloat during that time of uncertainty and frustration for you?
It did help, but it didn't materially help. And the reason is that this is back again to the histories of finance and Scottish football. The bonus structures going way back were not good for the clubs, because sometimes when you won a cup game, the actual bonus negated the amount of money you got for going through. Sometimes, in fact, it could even be a negative. Do you know, there's been times where I've known chairmen watching their team playing financially, wanting their team not to win because of the bonuses, which is just all wrong. It's just, I think, that again, chasing the Holy Grail, the structures, bonus structures and the finances of football got out of control. I remember one chairman telling me that he thought if his team won a semi-final game, to get to a final, they'd lose money. Which, I mean, I know...
It's just all sorts of wrong.
Well, it's crazy to believe that it's true, but I believe it was true at the time. From what I could see, the bonus structure, even at Motherwell, it didn't really make a lot of sense. It was too heavily weighted towards the players, because that's what happened, you know, the way the market changed. So I do believe that actually was the case. you know, it's all changed fortunately since then.
The other thing I noticed, you were looking at the potential of using FurPat for events to help increase revenue. For me, that seems like quite a straightforward initiative, and something that's much more common now. I never really understood the concept of having this place that you could go every fortnight to,
but never ever visit.
Yeah. In the other 13 days, it just seemed nonsensical.
Yes, yeah, so I was looking at everything, as all clubs do now, to try and max out their ground. It's not as easy to do as people think, though, of course, arranging venues and the costs of it and the security and the health and safety and all these kind of issues. But yes, we try to look at everything like that. Again, we're looking at things like that because, as you say, you'd have thought having a cup run would bring you a lot of money, but at the time I remember it didn't bring as much as we thought it would. So, yes, we looked at all these things and it was just constant, really. It was constant because, as I say, there's no external money. If I can't pay the wages 1 week, I really do have a massive problem. I really have to consider shutting the club. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I was faced with in that 2 years. I mean, that 2 years, I'm not sure. I think it probably aged me maybe 15, 16 years.
We talked about the semi-final there. In fact, just to even go back to that, using the stadium for events, I guess that's quite ahead of the curve to start to think about doing that, given how prominent it is just now around Scottish football. We see even the offices at Fir Park are used for office space and such like, conferences during the week. But back in 2003, it was a lot more uncommon to be visiting for part for any other reasons than that 90 minutes of football.
Yeah, I suppose it's like all things in life, you know, you have to adapt to circumstances. So you look to use assets in certain ways when you have to. It's a bit like fans mobilising in a crisis. You know, I've seen a pattern now of football fans buying their clubs, including Motherwell, of course. So you've seen that pattern. Now, why has that pattern emerged? That pattern has emerged because clubs have gone into a crisis, there's been no other buyers, and the only people there to save them are the fans. So people have been much more far-reaching in the way they deal with these things, how are we going to raise money, how are we going to do it, and they think in different ways. And it was the exact same thing. You know, we're looking at, well, how can we just raise some money? We looked at everything. So you're probably right, we're probably a bit ahead of our time out of necessity. The same way the first fans that started to buy their clubs were ahead of, you might say they were ahead of their time.
Come the semi-final, you had been at Motherwell for a year. How tough was it to take a semi-final defeat? Because I would imagine, like the rest of us, at this point, it's ingrained in you.
Yeah, it was absolutely horrendous. You know, I was in a real dark room after that. It was actually, so I know how football affects people and affected me in the same way. I mean, when I was at Motherwell in the 2 years, I went to just about every game that I could. With actually my daughter went to all games with me as well, home and away. You know, so it was totally ingrained in me. And not only was ingrained in me in terms of the performances by this time on the field and winning things like any fan, it was the financial implications of not getting through and having, you know, it wasn't just me that was working hard. As you say, all these individuals you mentioned at the beginning, the supporters, supporter groups, the staff of the club, you know, Terry and his team and the players, everybody was just working so hard. And then when that happens, you just think you've hit the wall again. You know, you're just about to get something tangible and it's knocked you back. But you just need to keep getting up and going. And, you know, people think it's you're a tough guy doing a tough job, but quite frankly, I just go home and sit in a dark room and sob like anybody else.
Sounds pretty familiar. So the team had finished bottom of the table.
Yeah.
And in May, the vote to see whether Falkirk would be allowed to use what was then the Shybrake Celsius Stadium. I think it's had about 400 different names since then. Went 6-6, so Motherwell's future in the top flight was confirmed, or so we thought. There's an appeal process and this would drag on and until June, but there was a lot of anger again. Falkirk were pursuing all sorts of options. In the meantime, Stephen Craigan and Alex Burns joined from Partick Thistle, and Alan Dick in particular at Partick Thistle was very outspoken on those deals. Did it begin to develop a wee bit of a us versus them mentality? Because it seemed like the Knights were very much out for Motherwell throughout this.
Yes and no. I would say, generally speaking, because of the way people conduct themselves at Motherwell and the type of club it was, when it went into administration, there was a lot of shock, but I didn't think there was whole-scale hostility. Yes, there were some from some clubs and some people. There was some support from some and less from others, and some did attack us a little bit. But overall, I actually felt that we didn't have too much hostility. We were generally a nice, well-liked club, if there's such a thing. As time went on, yes, the hostility started to grow, and I think that was partly because clubs, for example, like Thistle, who in their own way had kind of done their own unofficial administration with the Save the Jags, you know, all these people working really hard, putting money in and everything else, they felt we'd kind of cheated, we'd taken an easy route, gone into administration, got a legal freeze on all our debt. Of course, there's nothing like that. It's a really difficult process. But that's, in a simplistic way, they kind of thought, how could we possibly be taking their players? Well, their players were out of contract and left anyway. And as I say, we only took on a kind of net reduction. In fact, they were very good signings for us, I remember. But it was a net reduction that we took on. So I understood why they were angry. And they were a bit personal about it, I remember, towards me as well. But I did understand it, and I thought, well, it's just the job I'm doing. So I have to say that I think I was fairly thick-skinned and not letting that affect me too much. I had a job to do, and I thought I was doing it as fairly as I could. And I did understand why some people were upset by it, but I just took that in the chin and got on with it.
The following season would start, the 2003-2004 season. And in August, or early September it was, in fact, a dark day for the club. Again, James McFadden leaves for Everton. I'm still going home and sitting in a dark room, to be honest. In 6th year at school, I can remember we joked that we were going to go in wearing black armbands the following day. The sales of Everton strips in the Lanarkshire area certainly soared as well. Was that a case of finally a club matching their valuation of James?
Yes, it was a dark day, but it was a bright day, because really the sale of James saved the club. And if we hadn't managed to sell him, I'm not too sure what would have happened in year three, because we were running out of options with anywhere to go. We only needed one blip, and as soon as I can't pay the wages, we're finished, really. So I remember it actually well, because I was on a beach in the Maldives on a holiday, the tail end of a holiday, and of course we're coming up to the transfer window. And we'd started negotiations before I left, I recall. And John got involved in negotiations, and he did a good job. John isn't a successful businessman for no reason, fairly hard-nosed. Again, I apologise, my memory is wrong here, but I think that Everton started off at 500,000. But it was going to be a one-off payment. They were going to pay it all up front. And 500,000 was going to do it for us. And we got them up to 750. And I thought if we could get them to a million, even taking over a longer period, we could probably do a deal with our creditors. I was also mindful that what happens if James breaks his leg or something like that? You know, we don't sell him. And I think James was ready to go at that time as well, ready to take the step up. And we've got a disgruntled player. What happens if he's injured? Where are we going to go? How am I going to get the club out of administration? Been on the market for 2 years, nobody seems to want to buy it. So I was desperate to get that sale through. And I thought, having said there was no fire sale and toughed it out, I think we're going to do quite well here. Albeit, my own personal feeling was that he was worth a lot more. But he's only worth what someone will pay for. And there's no escaping, to some extent. It's a distress sale, we're in administration. So I thought if we can get a million, we're doing really well. Anyway, John got up to a million, I think, over a couple of years, but he was still pressing forward, and I think we got to 1.25 in the end, and I think John was still looking for more, and we had about a day to go, and I was having round calls round, you know, I phone that one phones that one. My mobile bill in those 2 days, I think, was something like £500 for 3 days, because, of course, the charges were huge then. But it was worth it for a 1.25 million sale. Anyway, I think John was still pushing for more, but it was, in the end, legally, it's my decision. But, of course, I need John with me. He's a major shareholder. He's a major creditor. Mm. And I got him to agree with me, look, we need to take the burden in hand here. And that was very, very stressful as well. So, yes, it was dark for the club to lose, obviously, James as a player, but it was what was saved the club,
yeah,
from a financial point of view.
I was looking back at October 2003, we were due to play Dunfermline. The match was postponed due to the number of youth internationals out away with Scotland. That is pretty crazy to even consider, isn't it? The squad levels were as such, with so many young players, talented young players, obviously, clearly too, because they were playing international football, that we were having to request the postponement of the games. And I mentioned the goodwill, I guess. The league obviously have a say in it as well, but Dunfermline agreeing to this postponement maybe goes against what I said 5-10 minutes ago, and bit of goodwill there.
Well, it was very mixed. That's the whole point, I think, with the other clubs. It was kind of quite mixed. You know, Partick Thistle, I think, were partly angry because of their own circumstances. And a lot of clubs that were really battling their own finances were thinking that Motherwell had taken advantage by going into administration. No, they probably realised that wasn't the case. But, of course, when they lose players and then Motherwell take them, you can just kind of see why they're angry. And it's football. Not everything makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes just sentiment overtakes you.
Yeah.
So some clubs were fine with us and some weren't. And some were sympathetic. Some were, Dunfermline were having their own financial problems in terms of their own wages as well, I think, at the time. So they probably understood it a bit better. And unfortunately for them, ended up going into administration themselves as a result. So I think some clubs were more sympathetic than others. But as I say, generally, and I don't know if I was blinkered at the time, I don't think so. I didn't feel there was too much hostility towards Motherwell.
The move taking Stephen Pearson to Celtic, was that the move that tipped us towards being able to pay the creditors? Obviously, it wasn't in the same level of financial benefit as the move for James McFadden earlier in the season. It was one that was met with a bit of anger. I think that's a natural one. I go back to only a couple of months ago and Jake Hasty leaving at the end of his contract to join Rangers. When Celtic or Rangers tend to be involved and taking their players, I think it's a natural reaction at times that people do get that wee bit more heated than if we went to an Everton or a team in the English Championship. It's just the frustration of losing one of what we perceive our own to one of the big two in Scotland.
Yes, and I understand that. Football is just, it's a crazy sporting industry. And you've all these sentiments and you've all these agendas and all different ways of looking at it. So you have to look at it from your own point of view as best you can. And I try and put myself in other people's situation as well. So if you take Stephen Pearson, his contract's running out. So his value's dissipating. Celtic approach is about buying him. And they make an offer, which I think is nowhere near his value. But you soon have no value because his contract will be out. Stephen wants to go. So there's, from my point of view, there's no choice here. I need to take the money. Wasn't entirely happy about it, the amount we're getting. Did I need that to get the deal done? Probably just about did, because that got me to the 25p in the pound. So it certainly got me there. But Stephen wanted to go, and his contract was running out, and we were getting money. So yes, fans are really upset. He would have been away anyway. That's the reality. So, but if I'm a fan, sorry, I would say as well, here's the usual. Rangers, Celtic, Old Firm, whoever it is, got more money, taking one of our best players again, just as we thought things were getting better. So, yes, so that's why I say I tried to put myself in the other person's place so I can see from their point of view. But, of course, I've got to do my job. And I was glad they came and gave me that, because that was what kind of just got us over the line.
And of course, it possibly wasn't helped, the hostility levels with the press pictures in the Celtic jersey before Link had dried in the contract. Is, I suppose, in a more modern world with better social media and stuff like that, that thing could have been managed a bit better. Was that? I suppose it puts more pressure in everyone involved at the club when external things are happening, driven by agents, driven by the press, and you can't really can.
I mean, I have no control over those things, and in fact, what's always frustrated me in doing jobs in the football world is the lack of control you have over so many things. One of them being when the guys go out on the pitch. You know, that lack of control when you're, you know, an accountant, it gives you that always a very uneasy feeling, you know, because you like to be in control of things, maybe just the nature of the job. And it's why I've always said about doing football work, I said, you know, it's a privilege to be able to do it. It's a great opportunity. But the thing I like about the industry most is I'm just visiting because I hate things being out with my control. And stuff like that is just totally out with my control, obviously. And there's nothing I can do about it. But I think you have to accept that. You're going to do work in the football world. There's lots of things out of your control. And you need to try and be thick-skinned. And I mean, one of the reasons why I don't think I would ever take anything permanent, I never have in the football world, is because I'm actually really not that thick-skinned.
Over 2 years on, and the club would finally exit administration, can you describe the emotion of that day when the creditors have been negotiated with it and dealt with, the club can move forward, they've not got that burden, and they've emerged from some of their darkest days towards a brighter future, certainly?
Yeah, it was a fantastic day for obviously the club and the fans and everybody involved, but it was also for me personally, from a professional point of view and a personal point of view. First of all, professionally, obviously, I feel I finally got there, did my job, that was the job I was meant to do, and I'm really pleased, and I'm pleased at the job I did, and you know, with hindsight, wasn't anything I could have done differently or would have done differently, so I was pleased about that. And if I hadn't got it over the line, I'd have at least have felt, well, I didn't do anything wrong, you know, with hindsight. It was just the circumstances. For example, if we hadn't managed to sell the players or no buyer had come along, it wasn't that I felt I hadn't, you know, done the correct things. So I would have had that comfort, but that's little comfort if the club dies. You know, there's a bit of comfort, you did the job as best you could. But so professionally, it was great to have got it over the line. Personally, though, it was equally just felt as good because by that time I'd been at the club for 2 years. I felt ingrained at the club. So it was a great personal feeling to know that the club was going to survive. And also I was confident they would go on, not just survive, but actually do well because the costs were greatly reduced. It was in better shape and actually had a good set of players there because they had these young boys that were all doing really well and had come through the system. So I also felt that post-administration, the club's going to do well. So that was a nice feeling as well. And I just felt that it obviously been worth all the effort and difficult 2 years. From a stress level as well, it was like somebody'd opened the cage and let me out. So that was a great feeling.
And I think I speak for the majority of our support, certainly when I say that you did deserve an immense amount of credit for what you did over that two-year period. Shifting it away from yourself, though, just for a second, how much did the likes of Terry Butcher, that playing squad, the non-playing staff, and also John Boyle in the latter part of administration, how much credit did they deserve for that work?
I think everybody deserves credit in their own way for what they did. Mm-hmm. And it was the joint effort. You know, we talked about a perfect storm that went into administration. It was a perfect storm in reverse that brought it out. Not just the sale of players, but it was the efforts of everybody up to that point that kept the club alive and going and breathing. And to get it over the line, John Boyle, he waived the major part of his debt to get it over the line so he could pay the dividend to the creditors. So he has to take immense credit for that. His financial contribution in doing that was absolutely huge. The intangibles of what everybody was doing, what Terry was doing, and the team and the performance and sanctity and keeping all that going, it meant that actually the whole thing was just a total joint effort. You know, it's just a total joint effort that got it over the line. So I think everybody involved deserves a lot of credit. And it couldn't have been achieved by just one person doing one job. It had to be a joint effort.
And it's very evident from speaking to you how ingrained Muddle has got in yourself.
Oh, definitely.
It's a club that certainly can get under your skin, as we've already talked about. Is that something that remains to the present day?
Yes, I know. I said before, you know, when you get into the football world, you don't want to start sounding too cheesy about things. But no, part of my heart is definitely still Motherwell, always will be. You can't be there for that period of time and being involved with the whole club and everybody there and not feel a big part of it. My daughter also, you know, she was with me through the 2 years. My youngest, she came with me to all the games. And we still go back to games. We still go back to games when we can. It's more difficult now because both our jobs take us travels and stuff like that. But when we can, we still go. Funny enough, we were just talking the other day about it, about we need to get to a game soon. So we still go back and, you know, part of you is just kind of always there. But it's a great club. There's a great feel about Motherwell. It's just a kind of community spirit. There's just something about the club that I think has a great feel about it. So yes, part of me will always be there.
And of course, administration became quite commonplace. You became a bit of a household name, shall we say, I guess, but from...
For bad reasons, yeah, unfortunate reasons.
But so often, you did what you did at Motherwell. You guided the team through, the football club through those problematic times and extremely worrying time for supporters, for staff, for everyone associated with the club. Why did this happen? Why did the bottom seem to fall out of Scottish football?
Yes, I know. You think lessons will be learned. You know, Motherwell was a wake-up call. And obviously, after Motherwell, players' wages did start to come down. And the club started to run their finances a bit better. You know, it was a good warning for other clubs. And I felt things were beginning to improve. But I think part of the problem was the reason for the demise of a lot of the clubs that went down was it was historic. The problems were already there. And although it might have taken another 2-3 years till something actually happened or till their individual or buyer or consortium or whatever changed and couldn't finance it any longer caused it, I think the problems with a lot were already there. It wasn't kind of new problems. In some it was. You know, there's another new, you know, sort of white knight who maybe doesn't get it right, or... Again, aspirations just get out of control. People forget the lessons of what happened to Motherwell. That was 10 years ago. So it's like everything in life, you know, you could say that, I suppose, by any industry. But I do think that Motherwell was improving the finances of other clubs. Other clubs were budgeting better. And the ones that actually probably mostly suffered, the problems were already there. And they maybe just didn't get out of them, manage to get out of them.
And just finally, to wrap us off today, bring it up to the present day, we've already spoken about the fact that sometimes supporters don't rally together until there's a threat of these gates being closed over for good. Now, in the case of Motherwell, the fans have rallied together and managed to become a fan-owned club, the first Scottish fan-owned club in the top flight. A massive achievement and something that I feel very excited by. Of course, we don't make a say in every decision in the boardroom, but the fan ownership thing buys into that community spirit, the community base of the football club. Do you see that as a model that is firstly sustainable and secondly is one that can benefit teams even at the top end of Scottish football?
Well, I genuinely believe in fan ownership because you know what the agenda is. If you see the demise of clubs over the years that have happened and still happening, it tends to be when the owners aren't actually fans. They've come in for a different reason, whatever that reason may be. And with fans, you know what the agenda is. Fans of the club, it's easy. But I don't think it works for all clubs. I think the main thing is, yes, I believe in fan ownership, and it's fans that have saved the last few clubs in the administration, but it's got to be the right fans. It's got to be the right management. And sometimes maybe a combination would be good. As long as the management's right, whether fans or not fans, that's what it's all about, managing the club properly. But I do like the idea of fans at least being involved, if not owning the club, because of the agenda. It's not always right for all clubs, because some clubs are PLCs, you know, and that structure may not work in that particular club. Mm-hmm. But in general terms, yes, I am a supporter of fan ownership. I think what you have to get right is just the right fans that are managing the club. To me, that's the main thing.
Brian, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew.
Talks of hostility and Maggie's mistakes, conditions of frailty, in the state of lacrimose, she's got an overdose of woes. She seeks a life through getting her every, she still longs for Romeo, and the paraphernalia can't help her now. She needs covered in snow. It's time to take it slow. And she said, where are you going now? I said, I'm going to the places I ain't found. I said, place a walk on Marlboro Gold and a cheap perfume. She's my body gone. Wearing the stripy top, I love the one that shows off her tattoos, the one that put me in a spell to make me go back to her room. Do you remember her friend Johnny, the one that she was kissing slyly? She took him round the back and she was kissing him contentedly, 'cause I don't think he'd be happy that she's found another man. I think that it might bother him, 'cause he's not my biggest fan. She said, where are you going now? I said, I'm going to the places I ain't found. I said, embrace the world, the marble gold and the cheap perfume. She's my body going. I ain't found, I say, bless.